From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now, and we're watching a new chapter in U.S.-Cuban relations. And talking about Cuba today, President Obama asked Congress to drop the embargo, what Cubans call the blockade, which was first imposed in 1960.
He also announced today that the Cubans and the U.S. have agreed to reopen their embassies in Washington and Havana. The U.S. embassy in Havana is expected to open later this month. Joining us now is Guillermo Grenier, who's at the Cuban Research Institute at the Florida International University. Guillermo, welcome back.
Thank you for having me.
And how big of a milestone is this from your perspective?
Oh, well, it's could be bigger, I guess, but I don't know how. I mean, it's been exactly 19,902 days since the U.S. Terminated relations with Cuba. And, you know, one of those definitions of insanity is that you expect different outcomes doing the same thing over and over again. So maybe now all the things that the U.S. has critiqued about Cuba policy can actually be addressed. I mean, how the Cubans run their country, that can be actually addressed through diplomacy or sanctions, or at least engagement. And so I think it's huge. And I think it's huge for critics of the U.S. policy as well as for supporters of the rapprochement, because both are interested in change in Cuba, most likely, and what has been going on for the last 19,000 days hasn't worked.
But there are still going to be a lot of roadblocks, including from Senator Marco Rubio, who is Cuban-American, Republican senator from Florida, but also a candidate for president. And he says he wants to block the appointment of an ambassador to be in the U.S. embassy in Cuba. Do you see big obstacles ahead?
Oh, there will be obstacles. There will be rhetoric about obstacles. Now, how, in effect, that has an impact on the operations of diplomatic relations being continued, that's another story. I think that we don't need an ambassador. The U.S. doesn't really need an ambassador to do the same kinds of things. An upgraded interest section is just as effective as an embassy in terms of personnel. And that is an appropriation that's already in the books.
So you don't think having an ambassador will make that big of a difference?
No, I don't think so. I think it will be a huge symbolic difference. And I think there will be, I mean, in terms of operations of diplomatic relations, I don't think it will be that huge of a difference. I will make that big of a difference. But I think that it will be a sticking point and something that can be negotiated for. I mean, we expect all kinds of negotiations to go on from here on out. This is not the end of the story. It's the beginning of the story. We're negotiating with Iran, trying to get a deal, and maybe it'll happen, maybe it won't. I think that's how we'll see negotiations with Cuba go forward. Sometimes the Congress will agree, sometimes the Congress won't agree, and there'll be specific events that have to occur before the Congress agrees or disagrees. So I think that the diplomatic channels are open now. They will continue to be open, and we'll see what lies ahead.
And what about the comments from Congresswoman Ileana Ross-Leighton, who is another Republican from Florida and has been critical of the Obama administration's plans in Cuba? She says opening an embassy is not going to help the Cuban people at all.
Well, what has been going on hasn't helped, from her point of view, the Cuban people. So I would just suggest, if we've done something for 50 years that has not worked, it might be time to try something new. And we do have a whole array. We have a history. The United States has a history of dealing with governments that they don't agree with on human rights issues, on trade issues, and a variety of issues. And we deal, and that's how we deal with governments. So I think that the fact that now Cuba has entered that pantheon of normal relations, I think that, who knows, we might be able to help Cuban people even more than we've helped them the last 50 years.
Well, what are people saying where you are in South Florida, where there is a huge Cuban-American community, and many of them are on the Republican side and have been opposed to what President Obama has been doing? But at the same time, a lot of them, and a lot of younger Cubans, are very much in favor of a restoration of diplomatic relations.
No, that's right. And I think that most of the population here and in Cuba, 97% of Cubans are in favor of normalizing relations. But I think that a large percentage, if you ask how many Cubans, and as we do in our polls, which we've been doing these polls since 1991, and you see trends after so many years, and you clearly see that a balance has been reached where most Cubans want diplomatic relations, and most Cuban Americans here in Miami, South Florida, want diplomatic relations. And I think that that push has been led by the fact that Cubans keep coming from the island. 300,000 have come in the last 10 years. And younger Cubans in socialized into the United States, democratic, liberal, democratic ethos, believe that perhaps it's better to engage a government than to isolate it in order to bring about the changes that you want to bring about.
That's Guillermo Grenier, who is a professor at Florida International University and the Cuba Research Institute there. Professor, thank you.
Oh, thank you, Jeremy.
Well, to Yemen now, where the UN says the humanitarian crisis is getting worse. Fighting has killed more than 1,400 civilians and displaced more than a million. And Saudi Arabia is leading a coalition conducting airstrikes against Iranian-backed Houthi rebels who've taken control of most of the country. The BBC's Jeremy Bowen made a rare visit to Yemen recently and has this report.
I'm driving through the streets of Sana'a, the capital. There is a tremendous amount of rubbish and debris around, and I'm heading to an area which has been heavily bombed in a raid a little while ago. I can see broken down buildings and a crater too, where presumably a house used to be. This is your home?
Yes, home.
And what's your name?
Samir.
I mean, there's a lot of damage here.
Yeah, it's damaged.
What happened to this man's house then? It's completely gone.
Yeah, completely.
Man's arrived and he's produced a bit of the projectile that did the damage. Twisted piece of very heavy-duty steel, covered in jagged edges. What's your name?
Alcardi.
So, were you here when all this happened?
Yeah, I was in the car right there. My car was in front of it. We heard jets flying, and just out of the blue, huge explosion right nearby, and then another explosion. At that time, we just freaked out and ran away. That's when we heard the third and fourth explosion. This was the last one right here. This was the biggest explosion, actually, and a lot of people got hurt.
Can you show me what you got on your phone from that night?
Sure. Just the kids, the ladies, my friends yelling and screaming. I'm a med student. I tried helping a lot of people, and I saw my friend. He was screaming at me and crying, and he was pointing at the ground. He's like, he's dead. They lit a kid. He's around 5 years old. So I walk close by, and I see the kid in the ground with his head cut open and his brains out, and it was really... There's no words to describe what I saw.
So there were children who were killed?
Five, from this family alone.
What are people around here now saying about the Saudis?
They really hate them right now.
I'm in the old city of Sana'a. Very beautiful, very ancient, and also, sadly, very poor. And there aren't many shoppers either, because prices have gone way up since the Saudis imposed their blockade of Yemen.
Life is miserable. No water, no electricity, no diesel. This is the only place where you can get water during the day, and it's only available for 2 to 3 hours. The state and Saudi Arabia have destroyed everything in the country.
We hope that Mr. Cameron will not attack our country like Saudis. This is not correct. They don't have the right to attack our country. And that's why we hope that they will stop this aggression against our country.
People here are getting united in the way the British did when they were bombed.
Yes, of course. I am sure that they are united. You see? And this is the answer of Saudis. You have to take care, yeah.
But the explosion wasn't a Saudi airstrike. It was a car bomb not far away. We're now at the scene of the explosion, and there's a lot of debris. I can see a trail of blood on the floor where wounded were taken away, wounded or dead. This is a bomb outside a mosque. A few days ago, there were 3 bombs outside mosques claimed by Islamic State. There are people here who say it could be Al-Qaeda. The Houthis are also fighting jihadists who are hitting back. Layers of war are destroying Yemen. The civil war here was mostly a homegrown fight for power. But the Saudis say the Houthis are backed by Iran, something they deny. For Saudi Arabia, though, sending a message to the Iranians to keep out of Yemen is a major reason for the war.
I'm Hisham Sharaf Abdullah. I was a minister in the previous government. What they say about Iran only is some kind of an excuse There is no Iranian interference whatsoever. There was some kind of assistance to the Houthis. But as the government of Yemen, we didn't do what should lead to this. Saudi Arabia was a friend to Yemen. This was really a strategic mistake by these new rulers of Saudi Arabia.
I'm looking out of my hotel room window at the darkened city of Sana'a. Darkened roofs, dark windows, dark doorways. They haven't had mains electricity here for months. Yemenis are used to tough times, but what makes this time tougher than ever is the fact that their future isn't in their own hands. They've been pulled into the wider standoff between Iran and Saudi Arabia. And for Yemenis, that's very bad news.
The BBC's Jeremy Bowen on the ground. You're listening to Here and Now.
You've heard of Gore-Tex, the fabric in athletic gear that keeps liquid water out but remains breathable. Well, W.L. Gore & Associates is the company that makes it. It's based in Newark, Delaware. It's got a very unusual work structure. W.L. Gore is what's called a non-hierarchical workplace. Very few of the company's 10,000 employees have titles. They're all considered associates. As part of our series of conversations with leaders called View from the Top, let's bring in one of the few people at W.L. Gore with a title, the president and CEO, Terry Kelly, who joins us from her office in Newark, Delaware. Terry, welcome to Here and Now.
Thank you.
And what does it mean that you're a non-hierarchical workplace?
So I started at the company back in the early 80s, and so the philosophy has been in place now for over 55 years of really distributing leadership. And it was the view of our founders, Bill and Dee Gore, and they were, I think, quite progressive, if you think back in the 50s, of thinking about a flat organization. And his whole view is it was going to make the company more successful, just by driving more empowerment, would drive more innovation, more productivity. And so I'm fortunate that I kind of inherited that when I joined the company, and it was already well in place and had been operating for several decades.
But so how does it look in the office there when it's non-hierarchical? Does anybody have an office? Is everybody in the same kind of space? Do they all have the same stature in the company?
So I think as it looks in practice, it's a pretty dynamic where we organize more around opportunity. So it's pretty fluid versus it's kind of a static organization. I think the leadership moves based on what problems being solved. So I think in traditional companies, it's a pretty fixed hierarchy of who the leaders are and who they report to, where it's maybe a little bit more difficult to see that in our organization because we purposely try to make it more dynamic. I think one of the best compliments we received is when someone comes in to visit Gore, it takes them a while to figure out who even the leadership is. And as you think about in other companies, it's pretty obvious right from the onset, right? Who's the leader and who reports to the leader and so forth. And we kind of like that, right? Because it should be dynamic, right? It should be more situational and fluid. I think the thing also different is how the leader conducts himself, right? The leader is there because they had the support from their peers, and they know that. They've got to earn that every day. They're not directing the organization. They're not telling. They're doing a lot of selling themselves, right, in terms of why we should be doing this and really getting the organization on board.
And do you think that they're more creative, these leaders, as a result of this structure?
I think they certainly have to be more creative in terms of how they influence, because every day you're trying to, you know, hopefully get the organization to understand, particularly as you drive change, right, why we need to change. And so there's a ton of communication. And what I hear from those that come into the organization, they see that the level of engagement, the level of curiosity, the level of wanting to understand why we're working on something and wanting to buy into it and then support it is really great.
Well, how do you feel about having a title?
I really don't like the idea of having a title, to be honest. And so certainly for the external world, it's helpful that folks know, you know, who I am. But internally, I'm an associate. You know, every Gore associate, I'm an associate. And again, I may be in situations where I'm providing leadership, but then I'm also relying on a lot of other associates that are, you know, with their knowledge and their capability of providing leadership. So again, even in my commitment, leadership becomes very situational depending on the topic.
What are the drawbacks of this? Because this is a very different idea than the one that rules most companies in this country. There must be some downsides to this, or everyone would do it.
So it's a lot of work. So to create an environment like this, you know, it would be pure chaos if you didn't put a significant amount of time in terms of giving folks kind of what's the purpose of the enterprise. So for us, you know, our purpose is, you know, improving lives through our materials. And so we, I think that's what resonates with our associates. So they're all very much aligned that we're really advancing our technology into, you know, medical devices and industrial products and Gore-Tex fabrics and so forth. And so that's, you know, that's the first way we align is around our common purpose. But then we have, you know, I would say almost rules of engagement. You know, there's a lot of work that goes into establishing our core values. You know, what are our principles? You know, how are we going to make decisions? And so the role of the leader is really to make sure that they are every day creating that framework for associates, helping them understand the boundaries so that they can operate and be empowered. Because if you don't do that, it truly just becomes chaos, right? Everyone's going off in different directions, and it would not be very productive.
Well, and I have to wonder, how would you fire someone also? Somebody who's not on board, who you're not able to corral and keep up with the common purpose.
So you can imagine joining the company, there's a lot of screening in terms of, do you really believe in these core values? Can you operate in this kind of environment? Particularly if you're hiring someone that has leadership potential, you're really looking to see, are they comfortable operating without kind of that assumed control? You know, can they do it through influence? And so that's the first step, is trying to hire folks that align with that set of values. But then once they come in the organization, you know, unfortunately, not everyone, they find out that maybe it's not the right environment for them, or they're not able to perform. And so the best situation is they actually self-select out, right, that they realize that this is probably not the right environment for me. So that's, you know, partly what happens. But if you can imagine, again, you're evaluated by your peers and you're the one that's making the least contribution, that will show up, right, in terms of that, you know, that peer ranking. You know, it will show up that you're falling, you know, to the bottom of the list. And so for, you know, that's a great feedback mechanism to the associate, that you're not really earning that respect or making the kind of impact. And we'll put a lot of energy in trying to help that associate succeed. We have an interesting role in Gore, which is a sponsor. And so every associate in Gore has a sponsor, which is basically a personal mentor that's made a commitment to help that individual succeed and maximize their impact to the organization. And other times it just doesn't work out. And so, you know, so we have to deal with that too.
And do they end up leaving on their own, or do you still have to sort of force them out?
Both situations. So some associates, again, select out because they realize this is not the environment they can be successful. And you can imagine, if you don't get the support of your peers, it's probably not a very popular place to want to work. So right. they self-select out. But we have situations where, you know, associates aren't able to see that picture, and we have to address it as a performance issue. So not unlike other organizations, I think we just put a lot more thought and care into helping the associate, you know, before it gets to that point.
All right. I want to talk to you about what you make there at W.L. Gore, and that would be Gore-Tex fabric used in a lot of athletic gear. What is next for you as a company? What's the next big thing in Gore-Tex?
So certainly the most well-known is our Gore-Tex brand, and what's probably not as known is that we really are a materials company. You know, we were founded on, you know, the creation of a really unique fluoropolymer, and we've really developed products that go into a number of applications. You know, we're into hunting apparel, we're into outdoor gear, we're into various footwear products. And we're very excited about our medical device products. So we have a whole range of products that treat cardiovascular disease, again, based on this kind of unique material. We actually make a device that closes a hole in the heart. We are the lead provider in fuel cell technology. Membrane electrode assembly is our material that goes into those applications.
And what's the biggest growth opportunity going forward out of all of those possible applications for your product?
There's quite a few. We are doing some work in the pharma area, drug development. Some of them have to go down to cryogenic temperatures, and so that, you know, our materials, you know, have a very broad range of temperatures. So we're finding applications in pharmaceuticals.
Well, and you have been at this company, we should say, since 1983. Is that right? After you graduated from the University of Delaware?
Right. I was one of our early graduate programs was to hire engineers and bring them directly into the company. So I started as a process engineer, working in product development, and then eventually actually led one of our businesses that was selling military apparel. So another application of our Gore-Tex products is to arm our armed forces with Gore-Tex apparel. So that was one of my that was my baby.
Well, and are there applications from back then that are just no longer, nobody uses that anymore, that the company has had to totally shift away from?
So that's another discipline, is to continue to prune the portfolio. So we started the company in electronic products, making wire and cable, which is probably not well known. But as that market and some of those applications have matured, you can imagine we continue to challenge ourselves. Are we providing differentiated technology where our materials matter? And if the answer is no, we will kind of go move and shift to another opportunity.
And do you think it's easier to make those choices in a non-hierarchical workplace than it would be in a traditional workplace?
It's easier in the sense that once you get the buy-in from the organization and they understand why you've made those choices, I think the level of commitment is much higher. It's probably easier for a leader to just say, we're not going to work on that. And I always kind of liken it to, you maybe get an instant gratification because you've got the decision made, but you pay dearly in the long run because the organization really doesn't understand why the choice was made, you know, why their project was killed. And so we put a lot of energy to help our associates understand, you know, why, the rationale behind it.
Well, when you think about the difference in the manufacturing industry generally today versus 50 years ago, is this model something that you would suggest to other companies?
Absolutely. I do. I am humbled, though, that I maybe am fortunate that I inherited this and had the opportunity to let it evolve. The journey and the reward of having, you know, basically 10,000 associates feel connected, feel, you know, like owners of the company. That's, I think, for me, what's the reward for putting the energy in, right? Because it's a lot of work.
That's Terry Kelly, the CEO of W.L. Gore, joining us from Newark, Delaware. Terry Kelly, thank you so much.
Yes, thank you, Jeremy.
Greece's Prime Minister Alexis Tsipras has been tweeting all day, asking Greeks to vote no in Sunday's referendum on whether to accept budget cuts in exchange for European loans. Yesterday, of course, Greece defaulted on a payment to the IMF. Then Tsipras seemed to be giving in to demands from creditors, offering concessions, but they've been rejected. Nick Voglis owns a restaurant in Athens. Nick, banks are closed. Are you open?
Yeah, we're open, but we're basically pretty much this, just like being closed. Since it was implemented on Monday, the capital control procedures, unfortunately, the only thing you can withdraw from the ATMs is €60 a day, and therefore business has grounded to a halt since Monday morning here in Athens. We are open, but we're operating basically with half of our personnel.
Well, so explain further. I mean, someone might say, well, why can't you just use a credit card?
Well, we don't take credit cards in my shop.
Yeah,
and most restaurants don't take credit cards.
Right, because who trusts the credit? Yeah, at this point.
So
I mean, how are people going without food?
No, well, they do shop in the supermarkets. You know, when it was decided that they were going to impose the capital controls last Saturday, people got worried. They went to the ATMs. They filled up. There were lines at the gas stations. Yeah, people are worried, you know. They were not expecting this to happen here.
Well, and so how are you going to vote on Sunday, this referendum that your prime minister is calling for?
I will definitely vote yes.
Really? Even for more austerity?
That's right.
Why?
Because it's the only way we can stay in the euro. You know, in Greece, many, many years, they had to make a variety of reforms in the public sector, which didn't take place. And therefore, there was a bill created in public sector, as you well know, of about 300 billion euro. And if you want to be part of the euro and don't want to go bankrupt, you'll have to implement those rules.
Well, what do you say to those who say that this really isn't Greece's problem, that the European Union and the debt collectors, the IMF, are being too tough on Greece? Here's Paul Krugman, a columnist here in the U.S. He said, yes, the Greek government was spending beyond its means in the 2000s, but since then it's repeatedly slashed spending, raised taxes. There's nowhere more to go. Government employment has fallen more than 25%.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. I mean, they were on the right track. But unfortunately, the job was not completed. We are a country in the European community which has the biggest public sector in Europe. And all of us in the private sector spend millions to support the situation. So the only way that Greece really can become a true Western country like it is in the United States and Western Europe is to make these reforms.
Yeah. Do you worry, though, about a death spiral? All those people who lose those jobs and those pensions that get cut, they're not going to come into your shop and buy anything.
Well, they haven't been doing that the last 5 years anyways. Hmm. Look, the main problem in this country is the public sector. There's no other problem. Entrepreneurs here are very, very competitive. I mean, they have to let this thing, this monster that we call public sector, it has to go, it has to finish. Yeah. This is the main issue. I know they're difficult decisions you have to make, but, I mean, you have to decide what do you want. Greece cannot live with a drachma, you know. Greece will become a Cuba with a drachma.
That's Nick Voglis. Again, he owns a restaurant in Athens, a very strong supporter of Greece signing on to the bailout proposals from the European Union. He will be voting yes in Sunday's referendum. Nick, thank you and best of luck to all of you.
Pleasure to speaking to you.
After last week's historic ruling by the Supreme Court that same-sex couples have the constitutional right to marry, officials in many states where gay marriage was banned immediately began issuing marriage licenses to same-sex couples, but not everywhere. Some places in the Deep South have held out and continue to resist issuing marriage licenses to same-sex couples, including in Alabama, where NPR's Debbie Elliott is. She's in Orange Beach, Alabama. Debbie, welcome.
Hi, thank you, Jeremy.
And where is the pushback coming from in Alabama?
You know, there are several probate judges here who are pushing back. A few have actually turned away same-sex couples, saying they want to wait until the Supreme Court has had a chance to revisit its decision, something that is unlikely. But the Alabama Chief Justice Roy Moore has told probate judges they could wait for 25 days. But today we've had a ruling from a federal judge in Mobile who says that is not the case. You can't wait. You can't discriminate against gay and lesbian couples, and that every probate judge should comply. Then we have a different group of probate judges here who are simply getting out of the marriage license business altogether. This is happening in Alabama. It's also happened in Kentucky. They've said, you know, rather than violate their religious conviction that marriage is between one man and one woman, that they'll just close their doors instead. So that's sort of the lay of the land. You know, people are getting married everywhere in the South, but there are these pockets where people are resisting.
And where even if you're a straight couple trying to get married, you may run into some problems because the local clerk has decided they're not going to give any licenses out.
Right. You may have to go to the next county. And so I think the legal question now becomes, is that a duty of your office? And that's something that civil rights groups say they are ready to pursue in court as well. So as this plays out over this week and the following weeks, I think we're going to find that there are county officials who maybe want to stand on their religious principles and think that they have First Amendment rights to do so. The question will be, does that transfer when you hold public office?
Well, and if the federal judge's word is not enough and the Supreme Court's word is not enough, is there anything the federal government can do to compel these clerks to issue licenses to all couples?
Well, I think here again, that plays out in the courts. I think that, individuals have to start at their county level and say, hey, I've come in to get a marriage license. You're denying me this. You can file your complaint at that level, and then you can work your way up through the court system. And then if a county does not comply, a federal court could hold them in contempt. And you're talking, you're looking at potential jail time, whether or not your county can afford to defend that. I mean, those are the types of conversations that you're confronted with. And a lot of these officials are elected officials. So, there is pressure coming at them from both ends on that. A few people, both in Louisiana and Mississippi, have actually resigned. We've had a justice of the peace in Louisiana and a county clerk of 24 years in Mississippi who have said, rather than put my name on a marriage license for same-sex couples, I'm just going to resign my post. I'm not going to be a public official anymore.
All right. Well, we'll keep following this. NPR's Debbie Elliott in Alabama, thank you. And we've heard from a lot of gay Americans about just how incredible last week's decision from the Supreme Court was for them, how much societal attitudes towards gays and lesbians have changed over time. That's clear from The Rejected, a 1961 television documentary that was one of the first to openly address sexual orientation.
This is a program about homosexuality. What causes it? Is there a cure for it? What does the homosexual say about his condition? What does society feel about the homosexual?
The film was produced by a San Francisco public television station. It was lost for many years until now. Sam Harnett of NPR's Code Switch team has more.
Watching The Rejected is like stepping back in time. It's black and white, everyone's wearing suits and smoking. It all looks very early 60s. But the topic was so uncommon, so scandalous, the film was prefaced with this warning to viewers.
The program you're about to see deals with a subject which is controversial, delicate, and to some downright unpleasant.
Back in 1961, homosexuality was formally classified as a mental disorder. It was equated with drug addiction and alcoholism. This film challenged assumptions. It has progressive experts, like famed anthropologist Margaret Mead.
We have to say that homosexuality is a potential of human beings. That human beings are deeply bisexual and bisexual at different periods in their maturation. And whether the society...
Even more surprisingly for the time, viewers heard from openly gay men, like Hal Call.
We'd find, I think, that the homosexual is no different than anyone else, except perhaps in his choice of a love object.
Call is talking directly to the camera and a national audience. It's a key moment for gay men in America, a moment many scholars believed had vanished.
I just figured it was lost to the ages.
Bob Connolly is a film professor at American University in Washington, D.C. He read about The Rejected as a graduate student and has since taught it for over a decade. All he had was a transcript he'd found at the Library of Congress. When archivist Robert Chahosky called him and said he was searching for a copy of the documentary, Connolly didn't hold his breath.
I really thought, buddy, good luck.
Chahosky is the archivist at KQED, the San Francisco public TV station that produced the film. Now, you might think it would have The Rejected, but no. Archives cost money, and old news wasn't a big money maker. So Chahosky says many stations just tossed it.
They simply did not have room or the resources to catalog everything.
Recovering The Rejected is about more than saving history for Chahosky. It's personal. Chahosky came out in the early 80s. His mom still thought gayness was a mental disorder. As an archivist, he wanted to find The Rejected, which would have validated his experience as a teenager.
It just became that unicorn that I was looking for. Like, I get a little obsessive, I guess.
So Chahosky teamed up with another passionate local archivist, Alex Chirian. And together they went on the hunt, which ended up taking 6 years. Finally, the clues led Chirian all the way back to where the search had begun.
There's that cliched phrase, did you look down the back of the sofa?
A.K.A. the Library of Congress. Yep, it was there all along, buried in the archives with decades of footage from all over the country. Once Chirian got his hands on the film, he digitized it and sent a link to an astonished Professor Connolly.
I am totally blown away by this film.
Connolly says watching The Rejected is more powerful than he'd imagined. He says he could see how hard the gay men were trying to conform, to appear normal, and say things in a measured way that wouldn't shock viewers.
As we get further away from the 1960s, we tend to forget what things were like. And it's important for upcoming generations to know what their forefathers went through to obtain the rights that gay people have today.
Now, more than 50 years after The Rejected was made, it's helping a new generation remember that period of history.
Perhaps with more facts and more argument will come the beginnings of understanding.
For Here and Now, I'm Sam Harnett in San Francisco.
And you can see The Rejected for yourself by going to our website, hereandnow.org.
And this quick note, there's quite a vibrant conversation going on our Facebook page about our talk yesterday with Brian Stevenson of the Equal Justice Institute. He made the case that this country has never really acknowledged slavery the way, say, Germany acknowledged the Holocaust, that Germany has markers where Jewish families suffered. In the American South, the statues are for Confederate heroes. Well, yesterday at the last funeral for the victims of the shooting at the Emmanuel AME Church, the white mayor of Charleston, South Carolina, said something in the same vein. Mayor Joe Riley has been fighting for over a decade to build an African-American museum. Here he is yesterday.
We worked to build the International African-American Museum here in Charleston on Gadsden's Wharf, which was the place where 40% of enslaved Africans who came to North America were brought. We're doing this because The truth will set us free.
He went on to say, we're taught the dangers of the Mayflower, but not the dangers on 882 slave ships. We knew of the opportunities of this new country, but we weren't told of the mud, mosquitoes, alligators, and overseer's whips on the plantations. He says he'll keep on fundraising for the museum after he steps down after 40 years in office. Facebook has just launched its Instant Articles program, which gives publishers the ability to put articles directly onto Facebook, which means faster download for Facebook users, and it also keeps them from straying from Facebook to find content. Meanwhile, other social media sites, from Twitter to Instagram to Snapchat, are also looking to become news platforms. Here now, media analyst John Carroll has some thoughts on this social stampede to news. And John, first tell us about Facebook's Instant Articles program. How will it work?
They've entered agreements with a number of news organizations that will post their content directly onto Facebook, so that if I want to send you to a column in the New York Times, I used to send you a link. You would hit the link and it would take you to the Times website. Now you will stay on Facebook. The content is embedded there.
Yeah.
From Facebook's standpoint, they want to be the web. And so the more they can keep you there, the more they can provide you with what you want within Facebook, the better they like it.
And what are the publishers or the content providers? What do they get out of this? Let's take the New York Times. Let's say they've got a Maureen Dowd column, and they are going to put it right into this, what is this called, this Instant Articles program. So first of all, they have this relationship with Facebook?
They are working out this relationship, yes.
What are the finances of that?
Finances are, if New York Times sells ads to a company, its content, they keep 100% of the revenue. Mm-hmm. If Facebook sells the ad, the Times gets 70%, Facebook gets 30%. So this is really about traffic in many ways, to drive more traffic to New York Times content. Mobile is the way a lot of millennials in particular access all their content. So the Times wants that traffic, and Facebook can provide it.
Right, because they're getting their content from their smartphones, but they're staying more on Facebook. They're not going to the New York Times on their smartphones to get it.
It takes 8 to 10 seconds to download the New York Times website. That's a life.
Oh, that's
a lifetime
time.
For millennials. Yeah.
So the New York Times gets people that may not be going to them anyway. I mean, it's not like they're in putting their product on Facebook. They're not losing these people because they weren't getting them anyway.
No, right.
Yeah.
Facebook is a tremendous driver of traffic.
Okay. So a new Pew Research Center report finds that. They find that Facebook is the top source for political news among millennials. So this has to be why people like the Times are doing it, and it has to be why other sites are moving towards this.
Right. This is the wave of the future. And Twitter, for example, has a project, a new program called Project Lightning. Basically, what they're going to do is they're going to aggregate content around particular events or breaking news. A lot of people find Twitter hard to navigate, and so they get discouraged. This is a way for Twitter to give them information, which is what Twitter is basically about, in a really easy, convenient way. So photos, tweets, vines, videos, all of it will be in this one stream.
I'm still staying with the fact that Facebook, Jeremy is sitting here, is the top source for political news among millennials. We'll take that up again in a second. But so Twitter is looking to get more of this action. What about Instagram, which is owned by Facebook?
Right. Instagram is also looking to get into the business of event coverage and breaking news. They've revamped their search engine. They've added different search terms like trending places and hashtags so that, again, it will be more convenient for people to tap into what's happening immediately in their area or in any location of the world.
And then there's Snapchat. This is the app that sends pictures and videos, but they disappear after a certain amount of time. And they're right now hiring journalists to cover the 2016 presidential race. Also getting into the political ad business. They recently posted this short ad by the conservative American Action Network. Let's just listen.
Stand up for American jobs by calling Congress and urging them to pass TPA. Because if we don't lead, China will.
Okay, now is that going to disappear?
It has disappeared.
Already. Mm-hmm.
It was attached to a particular storyline last month out in Iowa. So this is uncharted territory in many ways. Snapchat as a sort of political vehicle is something that that is really breaking new ground. They just hired a star political reporter from CNN. They're basically curating this this information, and they're generating news coverage of the presidential race.
Yeah.
So this is going to be a venue where the candidates will likely congregate too.
This is quite something. New York Times publisher Arthur Sulzberger Jr. has long said he's a platform agnostic. He's not going to believe it till he sees it. But it sounds as if you're seeing it. You're seeing this news move to these platforms. You're nodding yes.
Yes, yes. It's all about producing content and then delivering it on the platforms that people want it on. So Arthur Sulzberger thinks that his content can go off onto any platform. One of the problems is a lot of his readers come from the digital world. A lot of most of his revenue comes from the print world. So you have to reconcile those two things.
Yeah. John Carroll, media analyst for Here and Now, mass communication professor at Boston University, will link to his campaign outsider blog at hereandnow.org. Meanwhile, Jeremy, what do you think about this?
Well,
Facebook,
number one? Still use my New York Times app, I will say.
Good for you.
But because it's a great app. It really is a great app. But if somebody posts a story that, you know, or a Wall Street Journal app or whatever, if somebody posts a story on Facebook or Twitter,
I'll be
happy to click on that too. Get it more everywhere. Fine. If more people are paying attention to the news, I'm fine with that.
You're platform agnostic too, right?
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I read the paper. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now.